Good morning and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Rod Diridon, Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute and your chair for today. Please now make sure that all cell phones, PDAs, and other noise-making devices are turned off. Today's program is being co-sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute. It's also being held in association with the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, the American Public Transit Transportation Association, and the Bay Area Metropolitan Transportation Commission. Before we begin, I'd like to tell you about some of the upcoming Commonwealth Club programs. This Monday, June 24th, Brian Michael Jenkins, one of the world's foremost experts on terrorism and director of the Mineta Institute's Transportation Safety and Security Center, will discuss the latest information on domestic and international security threats to the U.S. This will be a 6 p.m. program here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And on Tuesday, June 25th, Mike McCurry, former press secretary for President Clinton, and Frank Fahrenkopf, former chair of the Republican Party under President Reagan, will discuss the climate of political discourse in America. Both are co-chairs of the Commission on Presidential Debates and will also discuss the future of those debates. This will be a free 6 p.m. program also here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. For more information on club programs, please go to thecommonwealthclub.org. If you're not a member of the Commonwealth Club, shame on you. Today is a great time to join, and the volunteers in the foyer after the program will be happy to take your application forms. Commonwealth Club, by the way, has 20,000 members and is the largest public affairs forum in the world, and is now 110 years old. So it's a very pride-worthy and important organization to be associated with and to support. Now on to the program, which consists of two parts. We do need to announce that, unfortunately, Secretary Ray LaHood, Secretary of the Department of Transportation, who was going to be our keynote speaker, was unable to be here because of last-minute scheduling changes. And he has sent his very good right arm to be with us today. Catherine Katie Thompson, Acting General Counsel for the U.S. Department of Transportation, is with us. She knows what really goes on at USDOT, and she'll give today's keynote talk and take questions during the first hour. At the conclusion of today's first hour, Ms. Thompson, there will be a 5 to 10 minute pause, probably more like 5 minute, while we reset the stage for the expert panel. And we're very, very lucky to have five of the most accomplished people in surface transportation in the nation who will be with us today for that panel discussion. During the panel portion of the program, we'll also collect your questions and ask those questions through the moderator, who will be former Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Transportation, Mort Downey. It's now my pleasure to introduce the moderator for the portion of our program with Catherine Thompson. And that's the Honorable Norman Y. Mineta, retired U.S. Secretary of Transportation. In the Bay Area and indeed throughout the world, no one needs to introduce Norm Mineta. He was Secretary of Commerce during the Clinton administration, Secretary of Transportation during the Bush administration, and prior to that time, he represented Congress. He was a representative in Congress from the San Jose area and was chair of the Surface Transportation Authorizing Committee in Congress. He's appointed by George Bush in 2001, George W. He served until he became vice president of Hill & Knowlton in July of 2006. He was the Secretary of Transportation during that very difficult adjustment after the terrorist attack in September 11th of 2001. And he guided the creation of the Transportation Security Administration, the agency which now has 65,000 employees, and greets you so cordially as you go through any airport in the United States. Norm was a military officer and in military intelligence, and that is not an oxymoron, during the Korean War. And he also served, as I mentioned to you, in Congress, and did so iconically from our area. He was the mayor of San Jose in the early 1970s, the first Asian-American mayor of any mainland city in the United States. Now, would you welcome, please, I've got another page here. I could go on and on for several days with Secretary Mineta, but there is one more thing that I really would like to stress. He did receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian award that can be given to anyone in the United States. And he's a graduate of University of California, Berkeley. We're from San Jose State here, right now. But Berkeley's a nice, smaller, newer university in the area. We're very pleased to welcome the Honorable Norman Y. Mineta.
Rod, thank you very much for your very warm and generous introduction. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Norm Mineta, a former U.S. Secretary of Transportation, with the privilege of being your moderator for today's program. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download the club's iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. Today's program is being co-sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute, and it is also being held in association with the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, the American Public Transportation Association, and the Bay Area Metropolitan Transportation Commission. Our topic today affects every American, and that is funding for America's failing infrastructure. The recent Washington State Bridge failure is the latest example of an alarming lack of investment in our national transportation infrastructure. Does this mean that we are losing our place as an innovative world leader? Today, to discuss this subject and its related issues, I am very, very pleased to present Catherine Thompson, the Acting General Counsel for the United States Department of Transportation. Let me say a bit about Ms. Thompson. Catherine Thompson was appointed Acting General Counsel in May of this year. She had previously served as the Chief Counsel of the Federal Aviation Administration, and from April 2009 to her appointment at the FAA, she served as counselor to Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood, where she was the Secretary's principal advisor on energy, climate, and environmental issues. Ms. Thompson led the Transportation Department team that developed the historic joint fuel and greenhouse gas emission standards for passenger cars and trucks and heavy-duty vehicles. These new standards, taken together, will nearly double the economy of passenger vehicles by 2025 and reduce oil consumption by more than 2.2 million barrels per day. Ms. Thompson also played a critical role in the development and implementation of President Obama's blueprint for a security energy future and represented the department at the 2009 and 2011 United Nations Climate Change Conferences in Copenhagen and Durban. During her tenure at the department, Catherine spearheaded a number of other projects, including the negotiation and development of a new long-haul cross-border trucking program with Mexico, and the implementation of the U.S. strategy for responding to the European Union emissions trading scheme as applied to international aviation. Catherine also served as the department's senior sustainability officer, responsible for overseeing the implementation of the department's strategic energy and sustainability targets. Prior to joining the administration, Ms. Thompson practiced for 19 years at the law firm of Sidley & Austin in Washington, D.C. As a partner in the firm's environmental group, she focused on civil and criminal litigation compliance counseling and regulatory advocacy. Catherine is a graduate of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the University of Pennsylvania Law School. So let's please give a very warm welcome, Commonwealth Club welcome, to Catherine Thompson.
Very much, Mr. Secretary, and thank you all for having me here today in lieu of Secretary LaHood. He really is sorry. He wanted to be here in person, but we literally are in the midst of a transition and expect to have a new secretary on board by the end of next week, so he had important business he needed to attend to. It's an honor for me to be here on behalf of Secretary LaHood and all of the U.S. Department of Transportation. And we want to thank Secretary Mineta, everyone at the Mineta Transportation Institute, and the Commonwealth Club for hosting this important event and this critical dialogue. Secretary LaHood and other DOT folks have participated in many of the Mineta Institute's events over the years. On behalf of everyone at the department, thank you for your partnership, and thank you for keeping transportation at the forefront of the public conversation. I also want to recognize our wonderful panelists that will be speaking after Secretary Mineta and I conclude our portion of the program. Dr. Agrawal, Flora Castillo, Malcolm Doherty, Jeff Morales, and of course, Mort Downey, the longest serving Deputy Secretary of Transportation in U.S. history. Mort continues to be our go-to guy when we have very challenging issues and we need strong leadership with stakeholder engagement to get things done. Before I begin my substantive remarks, I wanted to take this opportunity to publicly thank Secretary LaHood for his dedication, his enthusiasm, and his tireless advocacy for transportation programs across this country. I didn't know Secretary LaHood well before I went to work for him, but wow, have I been impressed. He doesn't take a day off. He never stops advocating on behalf of all Americans, regardless of whether you live in a rural, urban, or suburban community, and his departure will be a sad day for the department. On the flip side, though, having had the chance to meet Mary Anthony Fox, we are very enthusiastic about him coming on board. He's a wonderful man, very smart, very dedicated, and he gets how programs work at the state and local level. So we look forward to working with him and engaging with all of you as we move forward over the next 4 years. As Secretary LaHood would tell you, America was built on big ideas and bold action, like the Transcontinental Railroad, the Erie Canal, and the Interstate Highway System. We became a world leader because generations before us had the courage and the foresight to invest in a better future. Right now, we have a stark choice to make. We can stand by and watch the rest of the world get ahead by investing in their infrastructure, or we can think big and be bold. We can build the kind of transportation network that anticipates the needs of tomorrow and encourages CEOs to hire and locate their businesses here in the United States. From day one, President Obama and the Department of Transportation have delivered on a big and bold promise to build a 21st century transportation network that is reliable, efficient, and above all else, safe. Within 30 days of the president being sworn in, he signed the Recovery Act. That bill gave us $48 billion for critical infrastructure investments. Over 2 years, we took that $48 billion and directly created 65,000 jobs and funded 15,000 transportation projects all across the country. These projects included roads, bridges, rail transit, ports, bus systems, and a lot of other projects that put people to work and provide support for their transportation needs. We didn't stop there. Between the Recovery Act and core infrastructure funds, we've improved over 350,000 miles of U.S. roads. We've repaired or replaced over 20,000 bridges. We've invested in more than 350 miles of new rail and bus rapid transit, over 45,000 new buses, and over 5,500 new rail cars. And we've helped to build or improve more than 6,000 miles of corridor rail and upgrade 40 rail stations across the country. Our progress in high-speed rail is especially exciting. When President Obama came to office, he made a commitment to bring high-speed rail to America, and that is exactly what we've done. As all of you know, California is set to break ground on the nation's first 220-mile-per-hour high-speed train network later this year. This project is going to give passengers the option of avoiding congested highways and airports, and it's going to put Americans to work. Because of our strict Buy America requirements, our investments in rail help us to support good-paying manufacturing jobs in cities across the country. But the transformative power of transportation is seen all across the board. In communities big and small, transportation investments have created jobs, promoted economic development, and helped us to compete in a global economy. Where we have invested in modern streetcars in cities like New Orleans and Tucson, we've seen new businesses open up their doors, new residents move downtown or back downtown, and new life transform what once was a forgotten part of these cities. Through our investments in NextGen, we're helping airlines to save fuel and reduce emissions, and we're delivering passengers to their destinations safely and more efficiently. Through our investment in ports, we're helping to move goods more quickly, which is good for trade. The greater use of our marine highways is also helping us to reduce congestions on our roads and improve air quality. The point is this: transportation investments are good for our economy and good for Americans, now and in the future. Transportation is jobs, transportation is efficiency, and transportation is safety. On the subject of safety, I wanted to take a moment and highlight our very strong record on safety. As Secretary LaHood likes to say, every day people board trains, planes, and buses, and the one thing they don't worry about is safety, because that's our job at the Department of Transportation. In 2011, for example, we saw the lowest number of deaths on our nation's highways since 1949. That's the lowest rate ever recorded, and we hope to build on that record. This accomplishment is in large part due to safer vehicles, improved awareness of safety, and strong enforcement. And as a result of the transportation bill, MAP 21, which President Obama signed into law last summer, we have new authority to keep people safe on our nation's transit systems. Many people weren't aware that we did not have safety authority to impose safety requirements on our transit systems, but with MAP 21, for the first time, we can ensure strong federal standards across the board, and we're excited about that new authority. MAP 21 does a lot of other great things for transportation, but I want to touch on the financing aspect specifically. MAP 21 provided $81 billion for highways and $21 billion for transit capital investment. It gave states and communities 2 years of steady funding to build roads, bridges, and transit systems, and it ensured the solvency of the Highway Trust Fund through fiscal year 2014. MAP 21 also transformed TIFIA into one of the largest infrastructure loan programs in history, making up to $17 billion in credit assistance available for critical infrastructure projects. TIFIA, that's the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, provides direct loans, loan guarantees, and standby lines of credit for major infrastructure projects throughout the nation. Since its launch over a decade ago, the TIFIA program has made possible 32 projects and turned $10.6 billion in DOT support into over $42.5 billion in infrastructure investment across America. Right here in California, TIFIA is helping to expand and strengthen the Presidio Parkway, which, as many of you know, connects San Francisco with communities on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge. And it's helping the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transit Authority build a new light rail transit line along the Crenshaw Corridor. TIFIA's popularity is undeniable. In 2012, applicants requested more than $13 billion for projects of all shapes and sizes. TIFIA is a great example of how creative financing can stretch our dollars further. It also shows us that creative financing will play a significant role in future transportation investments. I also want to mention our TIGER program, which Secretary LaHood lovingly says has been wildly successful, and he's right. The TIGER program provides a unique opportunity for DOT to invest in road, rail, transit, and port projects that promise to achieve critical national objectives. Since its inception under the Recovery Act, Congress has dedicated more than $3.1 billion over four rounds of TIGER to fund projects that have a significant impact on the nation, a region, or a metropolitan area. The TIGER program enables the department to use a rigorous process to select projects with exceptional benefits and focus on opportunities to improve project delivery and funding techniques. TIGER's highly competitive process, galvanized by tremendous applicant interest, allowed the department to fund 218 innovative capital projects and an additional 33 planning projects. Each project is multimodal, multi-jurisdictional, or otherwise challenging to fund through traditional and existing programs. On March 26, 2013, the President signed the FY 2013 Appropriations Act, which gives us another $474 million to invest in TIGER grants. Thus far, we noticed the availability of funding earlier this year. And applications were due by June 13th. By the close of the application period, we had received 568 applications from all 50 states and three territories seeking more than $19 billion. And we're in the process of reviewing those applications now and plan to make announcements before the end of the fiscal year. The future requires us to work together, to be creative, and to be resourceful. Everything I've talked about is good for transportation, but the truth is we're not done. California's economic competitor is not the state next door. It's the rest of the world. If we want America to continue to lead, to be a magnet for jobs and manufacturing, we must work together to invest in our infrastructure. That means supporting the transportation projects that make the biggest difference in our communities, installing new streetcars, building new tracks for high-speed rail, and updating aging pipelines. Right now, we have an opportunity to think big and be bold. President Obama proposed a budget that would rebuild and upgrade our infrastructure so our businesses have the tools they need to compete. His plan includes a fix-it-first policy to ensure that repair and maintenance of our existing roads, bridges, and public transportation systems take a priority. And it includes a Rebuild America partnership that will attract private capital to build the infrastructure businesses most need. President Obama's plan is exactly the kind of vision we need for a 21st century America. But we can't do it alone. We need people to continue to advocate for transportation funding. And we need our local leaders across the country to work with businesses back home to advocate for solutions and innovation. Public-private partnerships are going to play a big role in future transportation investments. The path ahead, as we all know, is not going to be easy, but it does require us to be bold. Generations of Americans before us had the courage to invest in the future. Now it's our turn to build something better for the next generation and generations to come. On that note, I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Given the fact that you talked about the Recovery Act, Tiger programs, TIFIA, the public-private partnership, let me sort of combine several of these questions that have come in and get your response to them. And I'm taking bits and pieces of several. First of all, has the politicization of the process become a detriment in terms of transportation funding? And is there any technology innovation that we can see coming in the transportation sector that would reduce costs of rebuilding and maintaining the U.S. infrastructure?
With respect to the first question, the politicization of funding, that has been a huge impediment. There seems to be a common shared goal of investing in transportation and infrastructure. And across the board, Republicans, Democrats, and everything in between have been applying for and seeking available money from the department. The stuck point is, how do we pay for these investments long term? And that's a discussion that we need to have, and politicians on both sides of the aisle have been reluctant to do so. I know it's a topic of extreme interest to Mayor Fox, and as soon as he's on the job, he plans to roll up his sleeves and engage in Congress and our stakeholders in a deep and intense dialogue about how we pay for things in the future. One way or another, it's an issue we're going to have to resolve in order to continue to move forward. With respect to the second question, I can't identify any specific tool or technology, but I will say that all of the applications we get through our grant programs or through our loan programs offer something new and unique, and we work with our stakeholders to build upon those, and to the extent they're successful, which largely they are, thankfully, we integrate those into our plans and thinking for how to move forward with transportation infrastructure projects.
What are the prospects of being able to get a gasoline tax increased or some other form of revenue to put into the Highway Trust Fund? And I'll add a parenthetical note to that question. Given the vehicle miles traveled and with your great work on fuel efficiency of automobiles, that means less revenue going into the Highway Trust Funds. And then we have electric automobiles that weigh more than the typical car, and yet they're occupying space on the road, and they pay no gasoline tax. So are there other alternatives such as question I saw about carbon tax or other vehicle miles traveled or other alternatives, since the Congress seems to be reluctant to raise the gasoline tax?
That is a very good question. The answer is, everyone knows we have a serious problem in that the gas tax is no longer capable of funding our transportation needs. The problem is, again, as I mentioned earlier, that no one is willing to sit down and have the discussion and lay all the options on the table, the pros and the cons, and figure out how this country is going to move forward. Both Secretary LaHood and I know Mayor Fox are willing to have that discussion, but we haven't even been given an audience to go up and discuss. We are open to all ideas. There are obviously some that the White House prefers more than others, but we want to talk about everything. No stone unturned. See what options may be viable and pursue those options. And we look forward to the debate, and really we look forward to all of you in this room and across the country helping to push our leaders in Congress to confront the challenge and make some important decisions sooner rather than later that can put us on a strategic path to meeting our transportation needs long term.
What about this whole issue of trying to regain what used to be our leadership in terms of manufacturing? It seems the question about seems that more and more manufacturing of our transportation modes are coming from outside of the United States. So how can we regain our place as a powerful innovator when we are failing in educating our young about technology? And I know that when you have planes or whatever being made overseas, that technology and that job is lost here in the United States. So is there anything we can be doing to get that turned around in terms of getting that leadership back that we thought was ours for a long, long time?
There are really several things. Some of our programs obviously have very strong Buy America provisions to protect and encourage the development of industry here at home, and we need to continue to advocate for those programs. High-speed rail is a great example, and the work that California is doing here. The other piece is we need to have an efficient transportation infrastructure in place to attract businesses. They need to be able to move their goods and provide their services seamlessly. And I think we're getting better at that. Over, you know, in prior years, we tend to look at transportation in silos, rail, aviation, highways. And through programs like our Tiger program, we've taken a more multimodal view, connectivity, allowing communities, states, and regions to figure out what best suits their needs so they can create transportation systems that work well together, create efficiencies, and become more attractive to businesses to locate in those areas. With respect to education in the STEM areas, the department has also been active on its own and as part of the larger Obama administration initiative to reach out to youth, young men and young women, and encourage participation in STEM programs. And we bring them to the department and over to the FAA for a lot of different programs to show them how we benefit from the education they can provide, the experience they can provide in delivering some of the innovative, exciting technologies that we're working on in the department today. And NextGen is probably one of our examples. It can seem kind of amorphous until you see a practical application of technology at work. And we've found that reaching out to young students, particularly in their early years in school, before they've had a chance to make a selection, has really helped excite them about STEM technology and the opportunities that STEM education can provide.
What about high-speed rail? Taking three questions here and combining them. Is the Tea Party directly or inadvertently responsible for the lack of funding for critical infrastructure projects like inner-city rail investments? And how does that impact on President Obama's dream of a national high-speed rail system to be realized?
I don't think we can ascribe blame to any particular group, but I will say it's become more and more difficult for people in this country to think and plan long-term in all aspects of our lives. And fortunately for us, President Obama was willing to step up and say, let's assess what our long-term needs are, and let's take some steps, proactive steps, to begin today to meet the needs of the future. We have had many, many challenges along the way, but we are focused, we are dedicated, and we're moving forward, and we're seeing success. So I think that the success will breed more success, and as people see, touch, feel, experience the benefit that these alternative or innovative transportation systems provide, will garner more support. But I do think that people fear what's new, fear what's unknown, and these are huge investments that take place over a number of years.
To what extent do tragedies like the bridge failures in Washington, Connecticut, Minnesota, how does that impact on the ability to get otherwise dollars that are being spent, billions of dollars spent in Iraq and Afghanistan? How do we get enough money to fix our bridges? And can the citizens somehow get involved in this effort?
That question is a very important question that harkens back to what we were just talking about, funding needs. We have tremendous funding needs that are not currently being met. We don't want to see tragedies happen. When they happen, there's a spur of activity and discussion on the Hill about how do we ensure that we avoid it in the future. Sometimes we will get additional funding, sometimes we don't. Regardless of whether we get the additional funding, the department does the best that it can with its limited resources to address the highest areas of risk. Again, we can't address all areas of risk, but we do endeavor to address the highest levels of risk to ensure the safety of our transportation systems.
Given your experience with a private law firm and given your international work relating to climate change and with international transportation such as cross-border trucking and the emissions EU impact, how do you feel that background helped you in your representing the United States in these international endeavors?
When I first came on board at the Department of Transportation after 19 years in practice, including 10 years working on two huge cases, I was questioning how effectively, how quickly government can work to bring things to reality. And when I walked in the door, I think within 2 days of my arrival, I was talking to folks at the White House who said, we're going to convene a group, we're going to engage our stakeholders, and in a month and a half, we're going to announce new standards for fuel economy for cars when those haven't been changed in decades. And again, based on my experience in private practice where things take decades sometimes to get resolved, I was a little bit skeptical. But that experience, you know, we did it. We brought people together. We brought the car companies. We brought labor unions. We brought environmental advocacy groups together, safety advocacy groups together. We had some extremely challenging issues to deal with, and we did it. And it has always been, for me, a model of success. We had a lot of heated arguments, but we were always respectful. We pursued all options, and we managed to strike a balance that satisfied everyone, whether you are an advocate for the climate, whether you don't like to spend money at the gas pump and you're going to be able to save a little money, whether you want to ensure that enhanced fuel economy doesn't mean that cars become less safe because they weigh less. We managed to thread the needle, and to me, and we did it with our existing authority and without any need for help from Congress. That is a tremendous success story. And I've taken that lesson and built upon that lesson in everything I do. Everything's on the table. Let's debate it. Let's look at all options. Throw something out that maybe we think is inviable initially, but let's talk through the pros and cons. I think that's been the same of dealing with the Mexican long-haul cross-border trucking program, which has been controversial. It's been true of the EU emissions trading discussions, which we have, that let's focus on the problem we have to solve, and let's figure out as a group how we solve it and how we can stand behind it. And again, I want to point to the fuel economy rules as being successful for another important reason. We were able to do that without any significant litigation. That's virtually unheard of. And those standards are in place through 2025 with a broad base of support from industry, stakeholders, environmental groups. That's a model for success, and that's a model that I've taken with me every step of the way at the department.
Let me interject at this time that you are now listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio Program. Our guest is Catherine Thompson, Acting General Counsel for the United States Department of Transportation, who is discussing how to fund and rebuild the American transportation infrastructure. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at FORA TV. So now back to Catherine. Catherine, in given the kind of work that you did on international transportation, is there a major international concern about transportation infrastructure, or is that more just us in terms of a national concern?
Well, I guess principally we're focused on our infrastructure systems here at home, but I know Secretary LaHood and others throughout the department have traveled throughout the world to build upon the lessons they've learned in the innovative transportation systems that are abroad. So principally we're looking to learn and build upon what others are doing abroad and bring it here at home, do it better, and innovate, take it a step further. Internationally, I think the biggest challenges for us is raising the safety standards of other countries. We have some of the highest safety standards in the world, and we're proud of that, and we want to make sure that others in the rest of the world have the benefit of those safety protections. And then the harmonization of standards, and the harmonization of standards is obviously important for global competitiveness, and that's one of the reasons that the EU emissions trading scheme was so controversial, not because the U.S. government doesn't support efforts to prevent climate change. In fact, we've been very aggressive in taking steps across all modes of transportation and other aspects of government to do that, but because the European Union was acting on its own without the support of the rest of the world in a way that would have an adverse economic impact on international competitiveness.
You have successfully blocked EU efforts to impose standards relating to aircraft emissions. Is there room now for an international agreement that contributes to emission reduction and creates opportunities for American aircraft manufacturers?
There is an opportunity, and in fact, discussions are ongoing in the International Civil Aviation Organization to come up with a global approach that's supported by all members of ICAO and can be enforced under the Chicago Convention. It's too early to tell whether that will ultimately be successful or not, but we are very focused on two things. One, taking aggressive steps to combat climate change and emissions of greenhouse gas emissions, but two, doing it in a way that brings the rest of the world along and doesn't force any country to follow what the dictates of just one other country or one other region of the world.
Speaking of safety, in the Netherlands, each resident has about one quarter the chance of dying in a traffic crash, and that's in large part due to the fact that so many people are not driving cars, they're riding bicycles. What's the role of the United States Department of Transportation in increasing bicycle use?
We, the department, don't want to dictate to any state, community, region of the world what works best for you, but we support the use of diverse transportation systems to meet the needs of your local communities. So we want you to use your transportation dollars in the way that mean the most to your communities. We've been big advocates for bike safety programs, bike pathways throughout the country, but again, where it is, we're in those communities that want them. So we are open to it. We also think in terms of our livable and sustainable communities, that it better connects people and provides the communities that they most want.
Although public-private partnerships seem to be the wave of the future in respect to building new infrastructure, How come the agreement isn't more forcefully made by those who oppose this finance mechanism when it costs more to be building projects in this manner, because the prospect for new funding and the profit margin of the developers sort of overtakes that whole picture. That's money that could be used for more infrastructure.
I think I understand that question. It's a complicated one. And I would say when we look at financing or funding for any particular project, we always look for at the costs and benefits, at the performance of the project, and the economic soundness of the proposal. So we don't advocate for one approach over another, but we want to make sure that the dollars invested will be well used and provide the benefits that they're expected to provide. So, again, we don't have a preference as to whether it has to be one way or another. We encourage people to be thoughtful and innovative about the funding options they bring to us, and we work with them to make sure it meets their needs, it's economically viable, and we move forward on that basis.
Let's see. Let's sort of combine several of these. What has been done to make public transportation safer after 9/11 for a person like me that takes BART every day? This is very important. And another question is, and again, following on this whole issue of public-private partnerships, what is the Department of Transportation doing to help states and localities developing P3 projects and the advantage of expanded TIFIA programs?
On the security front, I think most people understand that since shortly after 2011, Department of Transportation no longer has responsibility for transportation security, but we remain very concerned about transportation security and its impacts on public safety, and we engage with the Department of Homeland Security and the Transportation Security Administration on an ongoing basis to ensure the safety of our transportation systems. Most recently, many of you are probably aware that the TSA had proposed to allow small knives and other types of sporting equipment on the aircraft, on passenger cabins of aircraft. And the reasoning made a lot of sense, and that is that they believed, and we do not dispute, that those types of materials do not pose a risk to the flight deck, the pilot and the co-captain. We agreed with that. But what we thought it overlooked was the risk that those materials pose to passengers in the cabin and flight crew members, and that piece of it had not been assessed. So we raised our concerns with the TSA, and we provided them with data available to us, and many of the airlines did the same. And as a result of our concerns and concerns raised by a number of others, they have withdrawn that proposed rule. So that's an example of how we don't have jurisdiction over transportation security, but we continue to be advocates for transportation security.
This region and the nation are dependent on efficient intermodal freight transportation to support economic growth. What is DOT doing to help invest in well-connected freight investments?
Perfect timing for that question. I want to say a lot of our programs that we funded to date, particularly some of our Tiger projects, have gone to fund multimodal projects. And recently, on the freight side specifically, we announced the creation of an advisory group, and Mort Downey here in the front row has agreed to co-chair that group. We're convening the group of 47 members, so he's got his work cut out for him in trying to maintain law and order in the group. But their charge is to address a number of these challenging issues about how we improve our freight systems, how we move freight more efficiently and safely across the department. So in the coming months, We look to see some recommendations coming from that advisory group, and we're going to hold Mort responsible for that.
What is the status of high-speed rail across the country? And what shape are the nation's railroads in? Can you include in that discussion the California High-Speed Rail Plan, specifically the outlook for federal and private funding?
I can't provide a lot of detail just because I don't have it readily handy, but we are very, very pleased with the state of matters here in California. I mean, California is a leader in so many areas, and high-speed rail is no different. The fact that they're breaking ground this year is very exciting, and we look for the developments here in California to spur excitement across the country. We have done a lot. California will be the first true high-speed rail network in the country, but we've also done a lot to invest in increasing the speed of trains in other parts of the country, including Illinois, for example, and have had some great successes. So it's a slow process, but the more success we see, the even greater success we'll see down the road.
Do you think self-driven cars are a realistic way of creating a safer and faster network of transportation?
We could spend a whole day on that topic. We think that technology in cars has the opportunity to provide a whole array of benefits, particularly safety benefits, but it's still in the early developmental phases, and we want to make sure we're not moving too far too fast and adding additional risk to the system. So, again, we work with the states. We work with interested stakeholders like industry to make sure we've got solid research, the systems that are being used are safe, well understood before we would introduce them more broadly. I think Secretary LaHood would tell you he's skeptical of the day when we would have self-driven cars used widely across the country, but they certainly provide some real opportunities in controlled circumstances and possibly in additional areas as well.
Given the interest in rail, increased use of rail, do you believe positive train control will be fully compliant by 2015?
Positive train control is a critical safety program that we believe needs to be implemented and needs to be implemented on schedule. We certainly hope it will be by 2015. If it's not, we'll move it as quickly as we can, but it's one of the things we need to do to ensure the safety of our rail systems. We recognize it's expensive, but there's widespread support and interest for moving forward, and we will continue to do that.
Talking about continuing this whole discussion about high-speed rail, have you heard that China is interested in investing in a former General Motors factory in Southern California, namely Compton, to convert it into a high-speed rail car manufacturing plant for the proposed Bakersfield Madera line?
I haven't heard specifically about that proposal, but I know that China is very interested in getting into the high-speed rail game here in the United States. As I said, we're looking at all options for funding transportation programs, but as I mentioned earlier, we also have Buy America provisions that are critical to developing our industry and building technology and capabilities here in the United States, and we will make sure that all programs, all high-speed rail projects that go forward continue to satisfy those Buy America provisions.
What are the prospects for passing percentage-based carbon sales taxes, starting very small and increasing at predetermined rates over time so that we can repair infrastructure and invest in mass transit and lower our carbon footprint at the same time? We could also rebate part of those carbon taxes to make them easier to pass?
That is certainly one of the options that should be considered. I mean, based on the current state of play, I think that's unlikely to be something that Congress would pursue. But again, as I said, all options should be on the table, and we should talk about what's viable and what we should pursue as a country.
As you know, the federal gasoline tax is 18.4 cents, and it hasn't changed since 1993. And yet states like Washington have a state gasoline tax, 36 cents a gallon, Pennsylvania, 31.2, Rhode Island, 31, Wisconsin, 30.9, North Carolina, 29.9. Now, those are the five states with the highest state gasoline taxes in the country. Is there, again, this is a repeat of an earlier question, but is there any likelihood of a federal gasoline tax getting passed, or even with an increase in the federal gasoline tax?
The gasoline tax has been so controversial for so many years, and the majority of members in Congress seem inclined not to increase the gas tax. And so I think the odds of increasing or changing the way the gas tax is imposed are very slim at this time, but I do think it's important that they be part of the discussion of options on the table. And I encourage those of you, again, I've said this before, but I encourage those of you who have ideas about long-term funding for transportation to get involved in the debate and reach out to your local leaders and your members in Congress, because we need to have this discussion and we need to find a way forward so we have a long-term vision for this country and we can make some plans on a steady and reliable state of funding.
Could you please elaborate on the new joint fuel greenhouse gas emission standard and what was the development process like for that?
I love to talk about this topic. I'm very passionate about it. It was like making sausage. It was a really ugly process, but we knew. We examined our legal authority at the department, EPA's legal authority. California was a part of the discussions. We looked at California's legal authority, and they all sort of serve the same goal, but do it in different ways. So we had to mesh three different programs to make sure we could, whatever we would require would be consistent with each of those programs and not conflict or impose impediments in another program. And then we put our options on the table. And for DOT, the standard for fuel economy is maximum feasible. It's not a specific number, but it means a number that within a range that you can defend legally as being the maximum feasible based on technology, safety, economic impact. So we had a range of latitude. We did our own assessment of data in partnership with EPA and CARB, and we assessed where we thought that range was, and then we sat down with the car companies, unions, environmental groups, and safety advocacy groups, and then we talked with members of the Hill throughout the process to try to narrow that number in a way to find sort of the sweet spot. So environmental groups obviously wanted it to be on the higher side. Many of the car companies wanted it to be on the lower side, and we managed to find the sweet spot that satisfied our legal requirements under the three different statutory programs and that could be supported by a very diverse group of stakeholders, and that's ultimately what led to our success. And we've now done it three times. We did it twice with cars, so we have a program in place through 2025, and we did it with medium heavy-duty trucks, which is the first time those vehicles have ever been regulated.
Based on your experience, do our existing permitting and regulatory processes help or hinder timely project delivery, particularly if compared to international project delivery times for similar projects?
Our permitting requirements serve important societal objectives, but I think many of us can agree that they do inject additional time and uncertainty into our ability to move forward with projects. And one of the things that MAP 21 did in a minor way was to add a provision that would improve project delivery by imposing fines on federal agencies who did not act within a certain time period to make permitting decisions that it would allow projects to go forward. We're having a lot of discussions at the interagency level about how those provisions will be implemented, but there is widespread support that we need to do better as a federal government to make sure that permitting, the purposes of the permitting are served, but it's not an impediment to move forward with any particular project and it doesn't inject undue delay.
Transit-oriented development is becoming popular. Yet some of these projects actually hinder access to transit stations. What is FTA's role, Federal Transit Administration's role, in ensuring that these projects actually are good for transit users?
Again, I think we have a healthy and active dialogue with our stakeholders to ensure that proposed transportation projects are serving their intended purposes. We will not dictate to you, to a local community, to a state, or in a region of the country, what you can or cannot do, as long as it's, you know, consistent with law, but we will encourage you to be thoughtful to make sure you're achieving the purposes the project is intended to serve. The other thing I would add is MAP 21 also added some new performance standards. So we used to, a lot of money obviously was earmarked, and there was no assessment of the costs and benefits of the program or an assessment of the how the project performed, whether it was performing as planned and having the positive impact it had hoped. So we will hold projects to higher standards that make sure they're achieving the performance objective they were intended to achieve.
So we are getting close to the witching hour. And I think the subject matters that have been submitted in questions from the audience have been pretty well covered. It's like that old adage about everything having been said, but not everybody has spoken to the issue. So let me try to maybe put these questions together and talk about, given the limited financial capabilities with Congress unwilling to increase the gasoline tax, what will the local and state government's roles be in terms of increasing financial finances for those projects in their jurisdiction, and what can we do to require increased private capital for public-private partnerships in funding our infrastructure needs?
Everyone is obviously mindful that there are limited dollars available, and one of the things we need to do, as I said, one of the aspects of MAP 21 that will be helpful, is we need to assess the costs and benefits of each program, make wise choices, and for the projects we choose to pursue, make sure they are meeting the performance objectives before we begin construction. We don't have the luxury of spreading it like peanut butter and funding everything. We have to be very strategic in the choices we make and how we move forward with those projects. In terms of funding, I think state, federal, and local leaders need to engage in a dialogue and look at available funding options and talk about what's viable in any given case. We obviously have a number of tools available to us at the department in our existing programs, but if there are other vehicles that we should pursue or you think we have the authority to pursue, let's talk about it. We want to hear from you. If we haven't thought about it and you have, that's terrific. We'd love to hear from you.
Given the ability to, again, get tax increased funding through the gasoline tax, should we be funding more of the transportation projects with user fees and moving to a broader based fee or some hybrid mix?
Again, I can't speak to the pros or cons of any particular option other than to say if we have ideas, all options ought to be on the table and we ought to have the public debate.
The issue of user fees, of course, was the whole reason for the gasoline tax, because that was directly connected with the user funding the Highway Trust Fund to build the projects. But now that the gasoline tax is insufficient to support the infrastructure needs, do you think you will be seeing more toll roads and other kinds of user pay systems instead of the broader gasoline tax approach that we've had in the past?
I think we will, and I think you're already seeing it in states across the country that to fund critical projects, they're looking to alternative options, including user fees. And Virginia just passed a new transportation bill this spring, and one of the things they did was try to grapple with this issue of hybrids and electric vehicles, which obviously pay less in terms of gasoline tax, and they are imposing a fee, I think it's $100 per vehicle, on each of the vehicles to ensure that the state has sufficient funds to meet its transportation needs.
So, again, our thanks goes to Catherine Thompson, the Acting General Counsel for the United States Department of Transportation. This program has been held in association with the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, the American Public Transportation Association, and the Bay Area Metropolitan Transportation Commission. So we want to thank all of you in our audience here today and in the radio, television, and the internet world as well. At this time, I would also like to remind everyone in this room that following the conclusion of this portion of the program, our panel discussion will take place following an approximate 5-minute pause to reset the stage. So again, I want to thank Ms. Thompson for an excellent presentation. I'm Norm Mineta, a former U.S. Secretary of Transportation, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.